You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on Irritable Bowel Syndrome, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Lin Chang. Dr. Chang is the co-director of the G. Oppenheimer Center for Neurobiology of Stress and Resilience and vice chief of the Vache and Tamara Manoukian Division of Digestive Diseases at UCLA. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for U.S. healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Lin Chang, and welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on IBS. Today, we'll be discussing treatments for IBS with a focus on pharmacologic therapies with Dr. Anthony Lembo. Dr. Lembo is Vice Chair of Research for Cleveland Clinic's Digestive Disease and Surgery Institute. Welcome to In Discussion. So it's so great to have you here with us today, Tony, to talk about a topic that I know that you are very knowledgeable on. You may be arguably the most knowledgeable person in the world on this topic of treatment with IBS, particular pharmacotherapy. I want to start off with you telling us about yourself and how you became interested in IBS.
Well, thank you, Lynn. First, it's great to be here, and thank you for the invitation. So I became interested in IBS when I was a medical resident at UCLA looking for some research projects. And there was a young researcher that is just starting out in his career named Emron Meyer, who you and I and many others listening will know Emron incredibly well. But back then, he wasn't as well known in the field. But he was interested in the topic of irritable bowel syndrome. And back then, there were no drugs that were FDA approved and limited amount of research being done. And Emron was exploring the role of hypersensitivity. So as a resident, I started to do some projects with them. We did a lot of rectal balloon distensions, showing differences between IBS, patients with IBS and healthy controls, and then IBD and other diseases. And then we started to do studies where we would give pharmacological treatments for patients. So one study where we gave a opioid agonist and showing not only that it reduced sensations, which wasn't a surprise, but the mechanism by which it did it, the type of receptors based on the distension profiles was different between IBS people and healthy controls. So started to delve into sort of the pathophysiology. Emron just, you know, is infectious in his enthusiasm and his intellect for research and for the field. And so that really got me hooked through my fellowship, which I stayed on with him. And then once I left to go back to Boston, where I was originally from and where my family is, I kept going in that field. And that led to a 25-year career so far in this area. And a lot of it, as you know, spent trying to understand the pharmacological treatments of IBS, which we're going to talk about more today.
Yeah, no, it's been great that you and I have both had the same main mentor, Emron, who has really helped pivot both of us to our careers in IBS. So I wanted to address treatments for IBS, which you have a lot of experience with. What's your general approach in treating patients with IBS?
So, I mean, the first thing that I do is delve into their lifestyle and other behavioral factors that can contribute to their symptoms. So whenever possible, I'll try to modify those behaviors to improve symptoms. Now, in many cases, it's not the underlying cause for their IBS, but it can be a trigger. And sometimes patients are not aware of that. And I know you've explored this elsewhere with the role of the diet, which is extremely important. Exercise, stress, sleep are all factors that can contribute to exacerbations and symptoms. And the extent that they can be modified, that can help patients improve their symptoms without using pharmacological treatments. Though in our practice, you know, the vast majority of people that come to see us end up with a prescription. And I like to believe that's because they need it and they've, you know, exhausted or, you know, the lifestyle and the other behavioral type treatments. So I initially start with the behavioral and lifestyle, then I move into pharmacological treatments.
So I find that, you know, many patients are under the belief, and I think this is really something society does a lot, is to believe that you have symptoms because there's some structural or anatomic problem in your gut that's responsible and contributing to your symptoms. But in IBS, a lot of times it's really more, it's mainly the physiology is altered and you target your treatment according to what you think is the mechanisms that are causing their symptoms and you target treatment that attack that mechanism. Do you do that? And do you explain to the patients when you're going to start a treatment of why you're choosing that particular one, or you're recommending that based on their symptoms?
Yeah. So what you've touched on is extremely important. It is part of this whole doctor-patient relationship. And I know that you've discussed this a bit with Doug Drossman, who's like the world's expert on this. That's a big part of what we do, not only to establish rapport with a patient, make sure that they have confidence in you as a clinician, but also to educate patients. They need to understand the basic mechanisms of their symptoms, why they developed it. Even at the extent we may not always completely understand it, they need to know that as well. But some framework about how we're thinking of their disease, I think, is extremely important. And it's really important for the buy-in and the patients that they have to really believe that this is going to help them, or have at least a good chance of helping them, and understand why that I am prescribing this. We'll talk a little bit more as we get into talking about tricyclics and neuromodulator type treatments, which require particularly specific discussion given their mechanisms of action. So I spend a lot of time developing that rapport and then educating patients about the pathophysiology, and then telling them why I think this treatment is the ideal treatment for them. And even before we get into that discussion, you know, I always try to understand their beliefs. Some patients that we see just want reassurance. They're not interested in treatment. They don't believe in treatments, whatever their beliefs are. So I really try to understand that. And if they're just looking for reassurance to understand the disease, then that's what we focus on. I also present treatment options, though. And I'll say to them, look, these are the approved treatments. This is what we understand as being effective in a number of people. You may hear the side effects, the risk benefits for patients. And I go through it either way, and they usually take note of it. I think they respect that, too. They want to hear it from me that these are the potential treatment options for them.
Yeah, I agree. I also give them like a menu of options and alternatives, because I think that when they come to see an expert like you, they're thinking that this is the last stop, and whatever is going to be recommended or something they're going to use, if it doesn't work, then what? But there are many options, at least nowadays. I mean, back then when you and I were first starting, there wasn't that many options, like you had said. So we're really lucky that there's more options now. So how do you treat constipation predominant IBS? This is assuming that you're treating the different IBS bowel habits subtypes differently. In most cases, you are. But how do you treat that particular subtype?
Before we go into specifics, it's important to state that it rarely is it just one treatment that I'm giving people. So even though we may recommend a specific pharmacological agent, it's usually in combination with diet, lifestyle modifications, et cetera. Although we talk about them, you know, sequentially, oftentimes they're given together, right? Almost always they're given together. And that goes with pharmacological agents. So we'll talk a bit about individual ones as we go forward. But remembering that oftentimes we will combine them. And it really does depend on a number of factors. It depends on their symptoms. So in this case, we'll talk about constipation, meaning that their bowel habits tend to be harder, less frequent, straining, you know, the typical symptoms associated with constipation. We'll also look at the severity, you know, of their symptoms. So how severe, the impact their symptoms are having on their overall quality of life. It's important to ask them what their predominant symptom is as well. So, you know, is it pain with constipation, or is it bloating with constipation, you know, et cetera, with it? So, you know, then we'll discuss what else have they tried, and what are their beliefs or their interests of trying these different type of medications. You know, we have an algorithm that, you know, you and I, Lynn, published, you know, as part of the AJA guidelines for IBS, for IBS-C and IBS-D. But those are guidelines. And I think you and I and everybody, all clinicians will take all those factors and we'll put it into our head and sort of think about, hey, I think this is best for this person based on all of those factors that we put together. But in general, as we say in the guidelines, in general, we start with the most conservative, least expensive, safe treatments. I mean, in general, again, and this would be things that are available over the counter for constipation. This would be fiber and an osmotic laxative. And typical types of fibers are the soluble fibers, such as psyllium, where there's the most amount of data, but it could be other types of soluble fibers. Knowing that for many patients, they are already taking, you know, eating a fairly good diet, it's worthwhile to go through it and see if, you know, exactly roughly how many grams of fiber we think it actually is. And in general, I'll still add a little bit of fiber to it, depending on what their diet is actually like. Of course, we try to increase the fiber in their diet before we do adding, you know, commercially available fiber. But something like psyllium is easy. You know, they can titrate the dose and they can get a regular amount every day. And of course, it does have side effects, just like the osmotic laxative would. And so remembering that it could cause gas and bloating in some patients, starting very low in the dose and then gradually increasing can help reduce those side effects. And I usually tell patients to give it a chance, you know, not to abandon it right away. If they get, you know, they don't like the symptoms, the side effects, to reduce the dose and then go back up with it. I generally ask them to give it at least a month of treatment, and I will generally combine it with an osmotic laxative, depending on how severe their constipation is and how hard their stools are. Osmotic laxatives are really just a good stool softener. So, you know, if you start lower the dose, you can soften the stools without changing the frequency in most patients that significantly. So that's what I tend to do with the patients, at least on the initial bout. Now, many of you may be thinking, oh, you know, all my patients, because these are over the counter, have tried it. They're not coming to me because just to seek, you know, something that's over the counter, they want a prescription. That may be true to a certain extent, but I invariably find that patients haven't tried it adequately. Haven't given enough time, abandoned it too quickly, maybe went up the dose too high. So I generally still ask them to try it, because I'll go back to what I said. This is usually done in combination with other drugs over time. So I really want to know this information. But those patients that may have very severe symptoms where pain may be predominant, you may bypass that treatment. I would probably be doing that as well for those type of patients.
Yeah, I want to get back to something that you mentioned about combination treatment, that there's multiple different types of therapeutic approaches. Also, when you're trying to determine what is that treatment really doing, is it relieving any symptoms or overall symptoms? But what is your approach when you're thinking about multiple different types of treatments like diet, lifestyle, over-the-counter or pharmacotherapy? Are you doing one thing at a time for a certain period of time so the patient is really clear on whether that's making a significant change or if there's a side effect associated with a treatment? What is your approach on that?
So for behavioral treatments, I'll do them all together. In general, I will tend to do them all together with patients. Diet's probably the hardest, of course, because patients are least likely to change their diet. So I tend to start with the low-lying fruit, like depending on what they're eating, to try to improve it. If someone's eating a very healthy diet, you know, I may not make that many changes, but for those that are not, I'll try to get them to just make those basic, you know, get rid of the soft drinks, stop dairy, that type of changes. And then I'll realize that that's probably not the ultimate cause of their symptoms or the majority of the symptoms. I'll add, you know, if they're constipated, I'll add one of the osmotic type agents. I think in general, we'll do that. Where I'll probably go slower and just start one of the time if I'm adding one of the, you know, prescription drugs that may have other different types of side effects. I want to see if, you know, a secretagogue is going to cause diarrhea, so I probably won't add it to an osmotic unless they really need to, for an example.
Tony, can you talk more about your use of pharmacologic agents, prescription agents for IBS with constipation? How do you determine what to use and you know, can you just give me your approach?
Sure. So first, let's just go over what's available for IBS. So we have what's broadly called secretagogues. These are medications that increase fluid within the gut. The first one was lubiprostone, second linaclotide, placanotide, and then tenapanor. They work slightly differently. So lubiprostone will open a type 2 chloride channel as its major mechanism. Linaclotide, placanotide, or GCC agonists, so they activate the guanylate cyclase C receptor that in turn through second messengers open up the CFTR that causes chloride to be secreted. And tenapanor blocks the sodium absorption as well as phosphorus absorption within the gut. So they are slightly different. Linaclotide does differ a little bit from placanotide in the sense that placanotide is more pH sensitive. So placanotide is slightly different than linaclotide because it's more pH sensitive, so it'll be degraded more proximally compared to linaclotide and may cause less diarrhea, although that remains debatable. So there, again, there are subtle differences. In general, they all work. They're all better than placebo. In network meta-analysis, linaclotide may be slightly better more efficacious for patients. And linaclotide also comes in three different doses, two of which are approved for chronic idiopathic constipation, the highest dose at 290 for IBS or diarrhea, but certainly they can be used, and I do use them in my practice at all three doses, generally starting at the lowest doses. Again, that's what we have available. As far as which one I'll use first, it really does depend. I mean, again, I do think linaclotide may be slightly more effective. So a patient with more constipation-related symptoms, I may use linaclotide first. Patients with more severe pain, I may also use linaclotide first. For those patients that may not have as significant constipation, I sometimes will use lubiprostone as my initial treatment. And then, you know, for tenapanor is the newest of the medication. I think by default, I'd probably use it a little bit less, but it also seems to be quite effective in patients. So I'm using it more and more, even as a first-line treatment, as they get more familiar with its efficacy.
And of course, it depends also on what the patient's been on before, or also their insurance coverage and getting access, because newer medications typically will require that they fail the older medications and a prior authorization. So that's part of the issue as well, too, the cost.
And we don't have, you know, a prokinetic agent for IBS-C. Tegaserod was reapproved in a subset of patients, women, you know, under the age of 55 without the cardiovascular risks, but is no longer widely available anymore. Prucalopride is another 5-HT4 agonist, so it's similar to Tegaserod, although it is a full agonist for the 5-HT4 receptor. Tegaserod was a partial agonist. It's FDA approved for chronic idiopathic constipation. That being said, you know, for some patients, I will use prucalopride as well, particularly when they have significant constipation and when I'm looking for a non-secretagogue type medication. Examples of that would be when patients will say, you know, my stools are particularly soft. They're just not being moved through enough. I need something to help push it through. You hear that a lot. From patients, I'll tend to pull out a prokinetic agent.
Yeah, and use it in combination with one of the other agents you talked about, like the secretagogues. Okay, let's move on to IBS with diarrhea or diarrhea-predominant IBS. What is your approach with those patients?
Well, as far as pharmacological agents, I generally recommend starting with loperamide and or a bile acid sequestrant. Loperamide, of course, is widely available. It's over-the-counter. It's relatively inexpensive. And when you use it at the FDA-approved doses of fewer than or equal to 8 tablets per day, is safe to use. And we tend to use it at very low doses. My average dose is 1 to 2 tablets per day. For people that have significant diarrhea or have concerns about incontinence or severe urgency, I'll have them take it every day in the morning, typically before they head out for work or for social engagements. Bile acid sequestrants, of course, are prescription agents. They're a little bit more challenging to get patients to take them regularly, but I do think in a subset of patients, they can be quite effective. And I generally tell patients that, you know, they give it a couple of weeks to see if it works, but generally they'll know quickly whether it's going to be effective or not. So generally, we'll start with one of those treatments. Then we also have prescription drugs. And here there are 3 FDA-approved prescription medications. Rifaximin, which is a poorly absorbed antibiotic, so gut-specific antibiotic. Eloxacillin, which is a combined opioid agonist and antagonist that's been shown to reduce abdominal symptoms as well as improve bowel functioning in patients with IBS-D, and then elocitron, which is a 5-HT3 antagonist, which is under a restricted program, but has been used extensively for many years for women with severe IBS with diarrhea that have failed conventional therapy.
Can you tell me when you use rifaximin, and then when would you use eloxacillin? I know elocitron is really more third line, but in which patients do you consider using rifaximin?
So this is where I usually have a discussion with the patient, because many people like the fact that they could do a 2-week trial of a medication to see if it has improvement in symptoms. And some people have fairly long-lasting symptoms up to several months after rifaximin. There are downsides, of course. It's very expensive and not always available to patients through their insurance company, but it is well-tolerated with it. So many patients are intrigued by this. Oftentimes they'll a report that they believe that the microbiome is altered, and so they like this as well. So many people come in asking for it, and I think it's not unreasonable to try it. And for eloxacillin, so I would say the majority of my patients will prefer to go with rifaximin. Eloxacillin, of course, is a daily treatment. It is available for people with a gallbladder. So if they do not have a gallbladder, they should not be using it due to the risks of pancreatitis or if they drink excessively. So some people are concerned about the fact that they may go drinking, have a few extra drinks on the weekend, and it's not recommended for if anybody has three or more alcoholic drinks per day. So I usually let patients decide on that. But all things being equal, a two-week trial is usually the way I'll go with rifaximin for these patients.
So I want to ask you two like nuances about rifaximin treatment. One, do you get a breath test? And I know this is a debatable topic. Do you get a breath test before you prescribe rifaximin? And my second question is, if somebody takes rifaximin, they do have a response, but it's short-lived. They get symptoms soon after stopping it. How do you handle those patients?
I don't always get a breath test before. There is some data to suggest that that if you have a positive lactulose breath test, that your odds of having success with the drug is higher. So that would be the rationale for doing it. But it doesn't mean if you have a negative test that you won't have improvement. So that's sort of the rationale behind it. Breath tests, of course, have a cost associated with them. We do them in-house, so it takes several hours, you know, away from home and work. Of course, you can do it at home on the weekends, but it still takes several hours to do. And even if it's negative, many of my patients at least may want to try rifaximin anyway, but certainly not an unreasonable thing to do. It is FDA approved for two additional treatments. So if you do have a response, and the key is it's important that you have a response, and have a recurrence of symptoms. And I generally will wait a couple months before giving a second treatment. I at least try to wait a couple months with patients. And then I will give them a second treatment, even a third treatment. I've had some patients that get recurrent treatments, you know, like every 3 to 6 months. That's rare, I would say, in the population. Generally, what I find is that if it works the first few times, it may not always work thereafter. So many patients will say, hey, it worked for a couple times, but didn't work after that. And then I won't retreat them after that.
Okay, so we only have a couple of minutes, but really quickly, can you give your also approach for IBS mixed bowel habits, diarrhea and constipation, which there's not studies on? If you can summarize it briefly.
This is the hardest population to treat, in my opinion, because there's not as much data on it. In my experience, many of these people have had a history of constipation related symptoms. And so I tend to make sure or evaluate them further for constipation, either by history or sometimes we'll even get an x-ray if I'm not sure which way they're leaning, whether they tend to be more constipated with diarrhea. I think that's particularly important if you're going to give a medication that can induce constipation, whether it be loperamide, bile acid sequestrants, eloxacillin, et cetera. Because sometimes they can really push them over and get them severely constipated. And I've seen that happen a lot. So I will tend to do some more testing on these patients to see. And then I will tend to start with the more gradual approaches in these people. So most of these patients I will actually give fiber to, even if I think they have more diarrhea. And I will be very gradual with the doses so I won't push them one way or the other. I think it's particularly difficult to chase the diarrhea and the constipation, because it often goes back and forth relatively quickly. And no matter what happens, we never quite get it right. So I think a more gradual approach is better. Those people that have more bloating symptoms, you will tend to focus on bloating. And there I may actually give rifaximin for those patients. And those with pain, I would use a neuromodulator, which we haven't even discussed yet. But those are the patients I would tend to use a neuromodulator on earlier than it would if they were one constipation or just diarrhea.
Yeah, it's unfortunate we can't talk about neuromodulators too much because those are very helpful, especially for abdominal symptoms like pain and discomfort. But I wanted to wrap up. I mean, you gave such valuable input. What are your key messages of IBS that you want to convey to the audience that maybe you weren't able to convey so far?
I think, again, when you're approaching a patient where you're going to start treatment, it's very important to remember, to talk to the patient, get their buy-in on it, think about their severity, the duration, what they've tried, and really try to put all those factors together rather than just say, oh, you need to try this or this, and really just have a good discussion with the patient. That What we found to date is that, you know, about half the people or less than half are actually taking the medication you initially prescribed. And it's not always due to side effects. Sometimes it's due to other factors. Even as simple as the insurance won't cover it. And, you know, we didn't know that in the clinic. And then it was 3 months till you see them back and follow up. It's just, you know, it's not really good care for the patient. So I really try to do all that, you know, look into all those factors beforehand. And then, you know, and I start with the simple things first, and then I work my way up into pharmacological treatments after I've tried the other, you know, the lifestyle, behavioral, and the over-the-counter type medications.
Okay, thanks so much, Tony. It was really, really helpful to hear your perspective. So today we had Dr. Tony Limbo discussing the range of treatments for IBS, particular pharmacologic treatments, and really gave a wide-ranging, thoughtful approach to patients and more personalized. And I think that's what's really valuable to patients. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Lynn, for having me.
This is Dr. Lynn Chang for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Irritable Bowel Syndrome podcast series with our host, Dr. Lynn Chang. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on irritable bowel syndrome.